3 weeks ago, we were conducting roughly 150,000 tests per day. Now we're doing approximately 300,000 tests per day, a 100% increase, and it will go up substantially from that number. This week, the United States will pass 10 million tests conducted, nearly double the number of any other country.
President Donald Trump in the White House Rose Garden under a banner that read, "America leads the world in testing." This comes as states struggle with how much and how soon to reopen, with testing capacity a big part of that equation. U.S. coronavirus deaths now topping 80,000. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, May 11th, 2020. This also comes as U.S. House Democrats preparing their own bill to provide perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars in aid to states. We'll get an update from Politico reporter Sarah Ferris. New York and Louisiana, two of the states with some of the highest numbers of coronavirus cases and deaths, are taking the first steps towards reopening their economies and societies. We'll hear from the governors. And the U.S. Supreme Court begins its second week of oral arguments by telephone because of the coronavirus with live audio for the first time ever. The case this week involves potential release of President Donald Trump's tax returns. And we begin at the White House Rose Garden where President Trump, touting what he says has been coronavirus testing success, taking a number of questions about who can get tested and how fast.
President, you're now promising that everyone who needs a test will be able to get one at some point soon. Can you give us some figures on what you're changing to ramp up testing? When will that be a true statement exactly? And how exactly are you going to accomplish that?
Well, it's a true statement already. We have more testing than any country in the world by far, but I'll let Admiral go into a little bit of the future.
Admiral Brett Giroir is also a doctor and Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary.
Look at the testing numbers that we worked with collaboratively with the state leadership. It's not just with the governor, but the state health officers, the state epidemiologists, the public health labs. It's really a combination of testing those who need something for diagnosis, diagnostic testing, tracing, so testing those who have been around the people with a diagnosis. But the largest fraction of that is really moving into surveillance, that is testing those who are asymptomatic. And when you do the numbers, this amount of testing on a state-to-state basis really is in the range that we need to accomplish all of that, certainly within the range that we need. So it really encompasses those three things. The other thing I would say is, particularly as we move into the summer, there are surveillance mechanisms, and I talked about them before, like a weather radar. And just think about that weather radar. The influenza-like illness network, which is at about 75% of healthcare institutions, and syndromic surveillance. So if we see a blip on that weather radar, combined with CDC personnel in every single state and with contact tracers, we really run to the fire, right? And that's when you detect, you trace, and you shut off that outbreak right when it starts.
Admiral Brett Giroir, a doctor and Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary with President Trump in the White House Rose Garden. The president also getting questions about a small outbreak at the White House itself. Two aides testing positive, including the press secretary for Vice President Pence. A Pence spokesman saying that Pence would follow the advice of White House doctors and not self-quarantine, because he is regularly tested. But at least three members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force are self-quarantined to some extent. CDC Director Robert Redfield, FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn, and top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci. Here's the questions to President Trump.
We had a situation here at the White House on Friday where a member of the vice president's staff tested positive for coronavirus, which has now caused three of the top U.S. officials involved in the coronavirus response to self-isolate. Two-part question, where did the system break down to allow that to happen? And what would you say to employers to look at the experience here at the White House and say, are we ready for this?
I don't think the system broke down at all. One person tested positive, surprisingly, because the previous day tested negative. And three people that were in contact, relative contact, who I believe they've all tested totally negative, but they are going to, for a period of time, self-isolate. So that's not breaking down. It can happen. It's the hidden enemy. Remember that. It's the hidden enemy. So things happen. But the three tested negative. The one who tested positive will be fine. It will be absolutely fine. Yeah. John?
Hey, what do you Mr. say, Mr. President, to other companies who may look at this and say, I don't know if we're ready for all this?
Well, I think, you know, we have a lot of people in the White House, and we had one. Basically, we had one person. So we had a lot of people that work here. This building is shocking if you looked at the numbers. And it's also tremendous numbers of people coming in. Normally, you wouldn't do that. But because we're running a country, we want to keep our country running. So we have a lot of people coming in and out. Many of those people, most of those people are tested, depending on what portion of the Oval Office area they're going in. Everybody coming into the president's office gets tested. And I felt no vulnerability whatsoever, John. But the two people, as I said, and three people are, they have been tested and it's negative, and they'll be probably out of quarantine very quickly. Okay?
John? If I can follow up on that, your staff, your senior staff, as you just referenced, is able to get tested every day. When will it be that Americans across the country will be able to get tested every day as they go back to work?
Very soon. I mean, really very soon. It's an interesting question because normally you would have said that you are not tested and you would have been, you know, knocking us for not getting tested. So if we get tested, it's a problem. And if we don't get tested, it's a problem. But I like the way your question was phrased better this way, because it is a positive. We are tested. We have great capability. You look at all of these machines here. They're incredible machines. They're the best anywhere in the world. No place in the world has this kind of equipment. Other countries are calling, sophisticated countries, and they're calling lots of countries. And we're trying to make as much as we can available to them, because there's nothing like what we've been able to do in literally a couple of months. What they've been able to do, the private sector, how they got it done. This is a 5 to 15 minute test, as an example, the Abbott Laboratories test. These tests are highly sophisticated, very quick, very good. This is things that didn't even exist a short while ago. So we do have a great testing capability. At the White House, we're doing it. And I think, generally speaking, we had a call with the governors the other day. Generally speaking, without exception, they were all extremely happy with what's going on with respect to their testing.
President Donald Trump in the White House Rose Garden. This was his first regular news conference in about 2 weeks, but it did end abruptly. He called on a couple of reporters. One reporter stepped up and said, "You called on me." The president disagreed. They went back and forth a bit, and the president ended the news conference. We covered it live on C-SPAN Radio and C-SPAN Television. We have the video at cspan.org. And now to Capitol Hill, where the Senate is in session, the House not yet officially back. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell laid out the agenda for the week, which includes nominations and an anti-terrorism bill.
While our committees are working away here on the floor, we'll start this week by confirming two more qualified nominees to important posts that should not remain empty at this time. We'll begin with Brian Montgomery of Texas, named by President Trump to serve as Deputy Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Then we'll turn to Troy Edgar of California, tapped to be Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. Now, Mr. President, I understand that some of my distinguished Democratic colleagues complain that the full Senate should not have to spend floor time on these sorts of uncontroversial executive branch nominees. I agree. But as long as their own Democratic leadership continues to hold important posts empty for as long as possible in order to just spite the White House, as long as the minority continues to break from longstanding Senate precedent to obstruct even the least controversial nominees, then my friends will have to continue to show up and vote on them. The floor votes they say they dislike are the direct result of their own tactics. We're also going to take up important legislation this week. While COVID-19 rightly dominates headlines around the world, the United States of America also faces many serious threats before us, threats before this virus began to spread. And they're still with us today. So later this week, we'll turn back toward reauthorizing important authorities under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This is urgent because the House refused to take up the Senate's short-term extension of important counterterrorism and counterintelligence authorities before they left town. House Democrats let the tools expire, so we must act quickly to clean up the mess and renew these authorities, which our government needs to fight terrorists and check the agents of China and Russia.
The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He was followed by the Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and like Chuck Schumer did last week, today questioned why there was no coronavirus aid bill scheduled for debate and votes this week.
Here on the Senate floor for the second week in a row, we are living in the alternative reality of the Republican leader McConnell's making. He has scheduled no legislative business here on the floor related to COVID-19. None. No measures for the unemployed. No relief for renters or homeowners. No legislation to increase testing capacity. No proposals to help state and local governments retain teachers and firefighters, bus drivers and police officers. Looking at the Senate calendar, you'd never know that we're working in the midst of a national crisis. It looks like any other session. A few executive nominations, hearings on right-wing judges, legislation from previous months that the leader should not have delayed. It's just totally, totally divorced from reality.
The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Majority Leader McConnell pointed out that there are several coronavirus-related Senate oversight hearings this week on topics that include financial regulations and the state of broadband. But the hearing that will likely get the most attention is Tuesday with a key member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Here's more on this from Senator Schumer.
Now, tomorrow in the HELP Committee, there will be a hearing conducted remotely with Dr. Fauci. This is the kind of hearing we need, not once a week, but several a day. The American people need to hear from experts in a fair, open, and truthful setting. Until now, we've mostly heard from the members of the Coronavirus Task Force through the distorted lens of the White House press conference, where the president often prevents them from answering fully, interrupts their response, or even contradicts their fact-based advice. This will be one of the first opportunities for Dr. Fauci to tell the American people the unvarnished truth without the president lurking over his shoulder. Dr. Fauci, let it rip. But it shouldn't be this one committee hearing tomorrow, and it shouldn't be Dr. Fauci alone testifying, or even with the two he's testifying with. This is the routine oversight business of Congress, and now we're now in a crisis. It should occur in every committee, every week.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor. House Democrats are getting ready to unveil their bill for a next round of coronavirus economic relief. And joining us now with more is Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter with Politico. What do we know about what might be in this bill and when it'll be released?
So the Democrats have been working to assemble this bill, which is expected to cost multi-trillion dollars. And what we know is that this is going to be a really bold, ambitious plan. And there's talk about having money in there for mail-in voting. There's talk about having money in there for hazard pay for frontline workers. We know for sure that there will be a lot of money for state and local governments that are on the brink of cutting services in a lot of places because they simply aren't seeing the revenues and payroll taxes and all of that sort of thing coming in. So these governments are basically going broke. Democrats have said they want to put $1 trillion towards both state and local, probably split between state and then the municipalities to make sure the money does trickle all the way down. So there's a lot of things that they've been pushing for. Many of them they've been trying to get into previous bills, but Republicans have simply dismissed those. They're saying Democrats want to put down their own marker. They don't want to be forced to agree to what Republicans want. They're hoping that they put the boldest possible plan out there. They want to show the American people how much money they're willing to spend, how much they're willing to invest in the recovery. And they're hoping that Republicans will be feeling the pressure from their constituents who agree with them on a really bold, robust response.
What's the timing on this? When we'll see the bill and when the House may vote on it?
Now, it's really amazing to think how quickly they have written this bill. It's been in the works for a couple of weeks. The speaker and her committee chairs really got down to business last week, trying to winnow down the final ideas, deciding what exactly is going to make it into the bill. They had initially hoped to get that done by Friday. That timeline slipped. There was a lot of weekend work. Now we're hearing that the speaker will be releasing that plan sometime on Tuesday. She'll be briefing her caucus on some of the details later on Monday, and so we may hear a little bit more about exactly what might be in that plan. But so far, the speaker has been reiterating, you know, there will be a lot of money in there for state and local governments. She said there will be mail-in voting. She said there will be relief for frontline workers. There will be safety nets. Programs like food assistance. There will be a lot of money for testing and contact tracing. So we do know a lot of the tenets of this plan already. It's just a question of how big it will be exactly and whether the full Democratic caucus will be able to unite behind it, which I expect they will be.
We're speaking with Sarah Ferris of Politico. As you mentioned, and there's a lot of reporting describing this bill as a wish list and that it will likely not become law because the Senate may not take it up. The president wouldn't sign it. So when the House passes this, what happens next?
That's a good question. We don't know. The members themselves don't know. The biggest the reason that the House Democrats are doing this, of course, is because they haven't been able to lay down a marker of what exactly they want. They haven't been able to be the ones to have the opening bid to Republicans. And Speaker Pelosi and her caucus, which are getting really restive, they want to be able to show the American people that they're committed to working quickly and urgently, even as they remain homebound, because it's not safe to return to the Capitol yet for the House. So there's a lot of Democrats out there who just want to go very bold in this opening offer. Basically, they expect that after this bill comes out, the House will vote on it. They'll be able to then use that as a launch pad to start discussions with Republicans. But they want to show the American people first what they want to do, not what they could do if Republicans said yes. And those are the three bills that we've seen so far. So this is going to be a really important, as I said, a marker for the House Democrats. But it will not become law as we see it come out on Tuesday.
And you mentioned homebound. I want to ask you, you've been doing this now for a couple of months, as we all have. What is it like reporting on Congress, but having to deal with the restrictions, being from home, not being able to get to the campus, members not around?
Yeah, it's a completely different job. And the members, of course, are working furiously. I've been talking to a lot of them on the phone, over text message, over conference calls, and they have made clear, you know, they're all working 10 to 12 hours a day, mostly on the phone. They're doing a lot of Zoom and calls and Skype calls. And it's just a very different type of work that the members themselves are doing. They're doing a lot of casework. They've become, they are already the CEOs of their districts. They're essentially trying to run their districts. And of course, everyone in the districts needs help right now. So their jobs have fundamentally changed, responding to people's needs and businesses' needs rather than spending their time in the hearings, doing the markups, really digging into legislation. So it's a different ballgame for everybody.
Congressional reporter for Politico, Sarah Ferris. Find her work at politico.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer has promised to give lawmakers 72 hours notice before they are required to return to Washington for votes. Whenever that happens, you can watch and listen to the debate on C-SPAN and C-SPAN Radio anywhere on the free C-SPAN Radio app. If there's any doubt that the administration is opposed to what the House Democrats may put forward, especially aid to states, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was on CNBC.
I've heard very clearly from the president and the Republicans that we are not bailing out state pensions and other things. And I haven't heard from the Democrats that they're willing to do it. They want to throw a lot of money at this problem, but I think it's very clear there is not going to be bipartisan support that bails out states from previous problems. And one of the things we did last week at the president's direction, I think it was very important, we gave a lot of money to the states. We created more flexibility. So we said they could use that money for firemen, first responders, and policemen so that in no uncertain terms, the states didn't have to lay off those people because they were having budget issues. We're also very quickly opening up the lending facility that the Fed, working with the Treasury, so states that have cash flow issues can borrow. And as you know, with interest rates very, very low, states can borrow this money. Some of them would have to make changes because they do have balanced budgets. But this is a one-time situation that is quite different. But we'll be working with Congress to discuss these issues and many important issues like the liability issue. We want to make sure that if businesses open up, there's not frivolous lawsuits.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin on CNBC. And this is Washington Today. Now to some of those states, two of the hardest hit in the pandemic, New York and Louisiana, making small moves to reopen. We begin with New York, and the New York Times puts it this way: in the most concrete step toward restarting his battered and shuttered state, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo of New York announced on Monday that three upstate regions might partially reopen this weekend with limited construction, manufacturing, and curbside retail. He got a question about how it's going to go.
Governor Cuomo, what will Friday look like, May 15th? Can people just report for work at a construction or manufacturing company that's qualified to open at 9 a.m., start a business? And can a whole staff return, or who will give those answers?
That is going to be, as I said, this is now a shift, right? We're sort of going from phase one, which was basically a state-controlled one set of rules all across the state. That was phase one. This reopening phase is locally driven, regionally driven, and regionally designed. So the businesses that can open are the businesses that are approved by that region and approved with these conditions, right? Every business that reopens is going to have to meet certain conditions. The state set a certain number of conditions. Local governments may add additional conditions to those businesses and how they open. And that has to be done on a region-by-region basis.
They'll get that information sometime prior to Friday.
Yes.
Governor,
yes.
How long do you anticipate being at each phase? You know, obviously a lot of the big businesses in our area, in any area, is phase two. So how long do you anticipate it taking to get to that point?
It will be determined by the facts and the numbers as you go along, right? You are more of a visual person. You're turning a valve, increasing the economic activity. Your question is, how fast can we open the valve? You have a dial right next to the valve that says infection rate. You have another dial that says hospitalization rate. You can open that valve as fast or as slow to keep that infection rate below 1.1, which is what they call outbreak. If it hits 1.1, it means the virus is increasing exponentially. So watch that dial, watch the hospitalization rate, and the timing of phase one, phase two, phase three, it's determined by those two dials. It's determined by those facts.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in Rochester. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio saying today his city will remain largely shut down at least into June, but could begin to ease some restrictions next month if progress in combating the coronavirus continues. Now to Louisiana, another state with a lot of cases and a lot of deaths. Governor John Bel Edwards says there's been enough progress to take the first step.
After discussing the data with public health experts in the Department of Health, with epidemiologists and the Resilient Louisiana Commission, and really reviewing the data that we've been accumulating over the last couple of weeks, we will be moving to phase one on Friday, May the 15th. That is this Friday. And so we will be lifting the stay-at-home order. The next proclamation will likely be issued on Thursday, be effective Friday, and we intend to leave it in place for 21 days, which I think is June the 5th. And so the next time that we anticipate having an announcement like today will be on Monday, June the 1st. And obviously, we won't know what that announcement looks like until we get there and have the most recent data to look at. Obviously, like all decisions, this one involved a lot of time and work. And I want to thank the folks at the Department of Health, especially Dr. BU and his team. We wanted to make absolutely sure that we were following the CDC vetted plan that was issued by the White House Coronavirus Task Force and President Trump's phased approach to reopening the country. And I do believe that we are striking the right balance with this plan. And that balance obviously is between public health on the one hand in this public health emergency and re-engaging more of our economy, getting more of our businesses open, employers back to work, customers in our stores and restaurants, and so forth.
Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards in Baton Rouge. To Richmond, Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam confronting the fact that his move to go to Phase 1 reopening on Friday is being opposed by the top elected officials across Northern Virginia. He says he's okay with that.
As I've said, it's important that the Commonwealth as a whole can meet the metrics that we've laid out before moving into Phase 1. But I also recognize that we live in a diverse Commonwealth and different regions face different challenges. That's why the Phase 1 restrictions are a floor, but not a ceiling. While no region may move faster to ease restrictions, we're open to some regions moving more slowly. I have been speaking regularly with officials in Northern Virginia about this very issue. I asked them to send us a formal letter outlining that they are unified in requesting a delay. Uniformity across the region is critical to a successful strategy rather than having restrictions piecemeal across towns or counties. Northern Virginia localities sent me that letter over the weekend, and I appreciate the continued cooperation between our administration and these local governments. We all want a responsible, data-driven, health-focused approach. Northern Virginia health officials are using the same metrics that we're using for the state: percent positivity, hospitalizations, testing and tracing capacity, hospital beds, and PPE.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam in Richmond. Those Northern Virginia officials who sent that letter he mentioned are from the counties of Arlington, Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William, and the city of Alexandria. They represent one-third of the state's population, about 2.5 million people, but one-half of the Commonwealth's coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Now to Pennsylvania. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf facing criticism from state Republicans and President Trump about the pace of reopening.
This question's from WTAE. This morning, President Donald Trump tweeted that the people of Pennsylvania, quote, want their freedom, end quote, and also tweeted, quote, the Democrats are moving slowly all over the USA for political purposes, end quote. Do you have a response to the president's tweet this morning?
Yeah, I don't know how you stay safe and move quickly. We're trying to move deliberately. In Pennsylvania, I closed down the state. The Commonwealth closed down the state in a measured, staged manner. And we're reopening in the same measured, staged manner. I think that's aimed at keeping people as safe as we possibly can in these uncharted waters. And I think that's the responsible thing to do. The irresponsible thing to do, as I said earlier, is to just willy-nilly go off and pretend that we can wave a magic wand and go back into business and suspend the reality of this virus that's surrounding us.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf in Harrisburg. He also suggested that funding could be cut for counties that move to reopen faster than they're given approval to do so. President Trump will be in Philadelphia later this week, a Harper polling survey showing that he is behind former Vice President Joe Biden, the likely Democratic presidential nominee in the state of Pennsylvania, by 6 points. Speaking of the presidential election, Senator Bernie Sanders says his unsuccessful runs for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2020 and before that in 2016 been a success in shifting the party to the left on many issues, but will he give it a third try? He told The Washington Post's Robert Costa, today, probably not.
Do you want to run for president again?
I think the likelihood is very, very slim at that. I think next time around, you're going to see another candidate carrying the progressive banner.
Very slim. So there is a chance you could run in 2020.
Oh, Rob, let's go.
Hey, you didn't fully close the door, Senator. Right?
All right, let's not be a media person worried about what's going to happen 4 years from now. I think it's very, very unlikely that I will be running for president ever again. And I think right now what the focus, I would say, not only of progressives, not only of Democrats, but a lot of independents, moderate Republicans, has got to be how we come together to defeat this very dangerous president who is in office right now.
Senator Bernie Sanders, interviewed by Washington Post reporter Robert Costa. You can find the full video at our video library at cspan.org. Senator Sanders also says that he's staying out of Joe Biden's search for a running mate, but will continue to press him to fill his cabinet with progressives. Back to the coronavirus pandemic, people's concerns, sometimes fears over the virus, leading to other people seeing an opportunity to make money illegally. And the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, Joe Simons, told a House Consumer Protection Subcommittee that his agency has been cracking down on fraud.
We've sent more than 120 warning letters concerning COVID-related scams, and these have been highly effective. We've also pursued targeted federal enforcement, and we've worked aggressively to educate consumers. We recently obtained a preliminary injunction against a company based on allegations that the company was an imposter, holding itself out as the SBA and accepting loan applications from desperate small businesses that they thought were applying for CARES Act funds. We've also worked with the FCC and other industry partners to pursue VoIP providers that allegedly assist and facilitate illegal robocalls to perpetrate COVID-19 scams. The FTC is monitoring the marketplace and will hold accountable those who take advantage of consumers' financial distress or their fears and anxiety about COVID-19.
The FTC Chair Joe Simons testifying over the phone to the House Consumer Protection Subcommittee. The agency also looking at another issue that affects a lot of people, refunds of tickets for concerts and other live events that are not going to happen anytime in the future. Here's a question to the commissioner from Congressman Frank Pallone.
The problem that I have is that, you know, I just get a lot of calls from consumers, and we've contacted all the ticketing companies and sports leagues on behalf of the committee about their refund policies to try to ensure that consumers are being treated fairly. And unfortunately, I'm seeing that a lot of events are being postponed instead of canceled to avoid refunding customers to cancel the event. And they say, okay, got a refund, but it's postponed. We don't have to do it. So what can the FTC do to help people get refunds? And if Congress passed a law giving the FTC the authority to address unfair or deceptive practices in the live event ticketing market, as our staff has recommended, how would you use that authority? Those are my two questions.
Okay, terrific. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is a really significant issue. We recognize that, and we take these concerns really seriously. And if legislation is enacted, we'll enforce it vigorously to ensure that there's a consumer-friendly ticket market. To the extent that ticket sellers are engaged in unfair and deceptive conduct, including breaking their promises when refunds would be issues, we can address that now under our organic FTC Section 5 authority. And that's something that we're paying a lot of close attention to right now.
But in other words, what I guess I'm asking is, I just worry that they're all going to say, oh, we're not canceling the event, we're just postponing it. Does that matter in terms of what you can do?
It's just a factual situation that we have to deal with, and it depends on, you know, each situation could be different. A lot of it depends on disclosure and what the policies are that they've announced ahead of time and whether they're complying with those policies or not.
Okay.
So that would be one thing. And then what they've said, what they're saying now, like, for example, you can imagine a situation where they're saying we postpone, but they know in fact that they have to cancel, right? And so that
you
would
have
be
to look at them in, you have to look at them individually. All right, I just wanted to make sure you're on top of it, and I know you are, so thanks a lot.
Yeah, no, thank you.
FTC Chair Joe Simons with Congressman Frank Pallone, both over the phone at today's subcommittee hearing. USA Today reports that with concerts expected to be delayed or canceled into the summer, the industry is looking at a minimum projected loss of $10 billion, according to Dave Brooks, Billboard's senior director of live and touring. And if the shutdown extends into 2021, it would be even more catastrophic. Overseas now, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson getting more questions today about Sunday's televised address on his plan for gradually reopening the British economy. In the House of Commons in London, this from the opposition leader, Keir Starmer.
What the country needs at this time is clarity and reassurance. And at the moment, both are in pretty short supply. And at the heart of the problem, it seems, is that the Prime Minister made a statement last night before the plan was written, or at least finalised. And that has caused considerable confusion. So yesterday afternoon, there was a number 10 press release that said, from Monday, i.e. today, anyone who can't work from home, for instance, those in construction and manufacturing, should be actively encouraged to go to work. So it's understood from that that it was today was the start day, and that was for construction and manufacturing. A few hours later, the Prime Minister made his statement. There was no express reference to time frame. Today, in the command document, page 25, it says that these policy changes apply from Wednesday. And the list has been expanded from construction and manufacturing to other sectors. So now we have a start date of Wednesday and a wider range of sectors that are going back to work on Wednesday. So far, so good. One of the key issues then is, will there be guidelines in place to ensure safety at the workforce? They were being consulted on last Sunday. They were vague and had big gaps in. So under protective equipment, it just said to be inserted or to be added. In the document I've now seen, it says that workplaces should follow the COVID secure guidelines, which I assume are the same guidelines, as soon as practicable. But under page 22, it says they will be released later this week. So we know some people are going back to work on Wednesday. The guidelines have not been published. They're apparently going to be released later this week. So can I just ask the Prime Minister, will the guidelines, the safety guidelines, be ready for Wednesday? Which realistically means tomorrow, if workplaces can be ready for them for Wednesday morning. If not, is he seriously asking people to go back to work without the guidelines? Have the guidelines now been agreed with businesses and trade unions? That was the attempt that was going on Sunday week ago. And do the guidelines only apply in England?
The British Labour leader, the opposition leader, Keir Starmer, in the House of Commons in London. And this was the answer from the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party.
What we're saying now is that you should stay at home if you can, but go to work if you must, if your job doesn't allow you to go to work. And plainly, he raised properly the issue of people who don't have the right childcare, Mr. Speaker. And we will count on employers to be reasonable. If people can't go to work because they can't get the childcare that they need, then plainly they are impeded from going to work, and they must be defended and protected on that basis. If their kids can't yet go to school because the schools aren't back, then plainly they can't go to work. And I think people with common sense, businesses, employers with common sense, do understand that. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to get that message across. But I think one thing that was perhaps missing from his analysis, Mr. Speaker, was the simple fact that over the last couple of months, actually plenty of businesses, from construction to manufacturing, office businesses of all kinds, actually have been proceeding, and they have been working. They've been doing so in a way that respects social distancing, that is as COVID compliant as possible. And so, to answer his specific questions about the timescale for the publications of our guidelines. We will be publishing the guidelines on places of employment today, tonight. Transport will be out tomorrow. And we're being very, very consistent in what we've said throughout this period. At the very beginning, we said that you should stay at home if you can, go to work if you must. What's changed now is the emphasis and the encouragement that we're giving to people, as it were, to follow the initial guidance of March the 23rd.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the House of Commons. The British government did publish a 60-page document today detailing the plan on lifting lockdown measures in the United Kingdom. Those who break social distancing measures could face a fine between £100 and £3,600, the upper limit about $4,400. Back in the U.S., the Supreme Court began its second week of oral arguments held by teleconference because of the coronavirus, and these cases are also being broadcast live for the first time ever. One of the cases today involving teachers at Catholic schools in California who sued for employment discrimination after their contracts were not renewed. At issue is whether these teachers are considered ministers and fall under the ministerial exception to workplace discrimination laws. Here's a portion of the oral argument with Justice Elena Kagan questioning an attorney for one of the schools, Eric Rosbach.
Mr. Rosbach, I have a too long list of hypotheticals, so I'm hoping that you can answer them in just a few words, like basically, yes, he qualifies, no, he doesn't qualify. So here's the first one. A math teacher who is told to teach something about Judaism for 10 minutes a week.
And if he's teaching it devotionally?
That's all you know about him.
That's all I know about him. I would say probably not, because okay. It would be diminished.
A master who comes in, and you mentioned the Shema at the beginning of your remarks, a very important pair, takes about 20 seconds to say. A math teacher who was told to begin every class with leading the Shema.
I don't think that is likely to fall within it, because I think it would, again, be de minimis under the data.
A math teacher who is told to embody Jewish values and infuse instruction with Jewish values.
If it's that alone, probably not, but it really depends on how that cashes out in actual
practice. I really am asking these things alone. A nurse at a Catholic hospital who prays with sick patients and is told otherwise to tend to their religious needs.
I think a nurse doing that kind of counseling and prayer may well fall within the exception.
May well fall within it, okay.
Yes.
A press or communications staffer who prepares press releases for a religious institution of all kinds that they need.
That should fall within it because of communication under Alicia Hernandez's case from the Seventh Circuit.
Okay. A counselor at a church-affiliated rehab clinic who urges his patients to reconnect with their faith community.
That would be a probably, but it depends on how much connecting there is.
Okay. An employee at a soup kitchen who distributes religious literature and leads grace before meals.
My guess is that would be de minimis under the same kind of rubric as the Davis case that I mentioned earlier.
Okay. A church organist who provides musical accompaniment and selects hymns for services.
I think that usually would fall within it because that's an important religious function, and that's the main job.
Okay. A cook who's actually not Jewish but who prepares kosher-compliant meals for children at a Jewish school.
No.
No. Okay. What's the you got through them all? Thank you. What's the connection? What are we supposed to draw from this?
Well, I think we laid it out in our briefing, and that is what is it that this person is doing, performing on behalf of this religious body? So what is the function that they're performing on behalf of that body? It's not all religious exercise. It's a subset of the different kinds of religious exercise that are out there. It is the kinds of things that were listed in the Alito concurrence. It was listed as the sort of verbs that we teased out in the main opinion in Hosanna Tabor, which is preaching, teaching, guiding, communicating, things like that, that are crucial to what you do as a religious organization.
Eric Rosbach, an attorney. Questions from Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. Part of today's oral argument in one of the cases, consolidated cases out of California. Again, the issue, whether Catholic school teachers qualify as ministers and fall under an exception to workplace discrimination laws. Another case today dealt with whether states can prosecute tribal members for crimes committed within historical tribal boundaries. C-SPAN is airing all of these cases live, the teleconference oral arguments, on Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. There's a case dealing with congressional subpoenas for President Trump's financial records, including his tax return. Live coverage on C-SPAN Radio. One other note today about another case. The Federal Justice Department says it is reviewing the evidence in the fatal shooting of Ahmaud Arbery and considering whether federal hate crime charges are warranted. Justice Department also considering the Georgia Attorney General's request for an investigation into the handling of the case. Arbery is an African-American man, 25 years old, shot and killed in Georgia, in Brunswick, Georgia, in February. No arrests were made until last week after that video surfaced showing a deadly confrontation between him and two white men who have been charged. Well, this has been Washington Today. Thanks for being with us. Be sure to check out the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen to C-SPAN Radio anywhere and get our podcasts.